together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of Native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol, or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick. You know, there's alcoholism, there's abuse, there's domestic violence, there's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Yeah. Prison. It's like where we're trapped.
It's the most common misconception about reservations.
That there's some kind of abundance, that natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair. Because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland, and so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights, to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore, because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions, youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guests onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born to a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo Traditional Tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles, and there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate you know, the colonizers over here. And so for a long time, I think, not, I don't think, I know that, that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were treated, were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission. And that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, you know, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this in here in this area has been, you know, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, you know, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the, you know, the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And I mean, what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And up in, here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And we're, you know, there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something, too, about they still want to control what they're. And if you speak very loudly, you get they'll find ways to get you. So, thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, you know. And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So.
And with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Well, stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, Vice Chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Oki-Ida Warrior Society. He's former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today, in your perspective, to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands. You don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, you know, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma. And but that was only one area where they ended up doing that. Amongst the Dakotas in North Dakota, South Dakota, they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was lots of different I guess highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and those ones that like Geronimo, and those ones that have come through history that fought back. they fought back, and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had mounted horses and armies and fighting against people that were just essentially had to. They hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But there was those are things that people don't understand. Yeah, when you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did. And that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just the indigenous people were falling off, and they were dying. You know, it was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, when you see these little kids dying, you know, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but on the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity. And they were told that they were devil worshipers, these kids, that their parents were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't know the true history of what happened to our people, because the one that controls history or the textbooks and the is the ones that essentially write the books, and it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system, and then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people that the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that sell these products. But it was originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, these lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement. When in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages, how likely can we expect a change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a Native chief, Headmot Toyolakats, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Researchers have found that young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. New research shows millennials in the United Kingdom are still bearing the economic scars of the 2008 financial crisis and are struggling to catch up with the living standards of older groups, while US officials claim their American counterparts have closed the gap. In its annual intergenerational audit, the Resolution Foundation compares the fortunes of millennials born between 1981 and 2000 with their predecessors, including Generation X, born between 1966 and 1980. It found that after the 2008 financial crisis and the ensuing recession, the long-running pattern that had seen young people earn more on average than their parents at the same stage of life had been broken. The report said millennials born in the late 1980s earned on average 8% less at age 30 than their counterparts when the Generation X cohort, when they were at the same age. In the United States, by contrast, officials claim while the crisis also made a significant dent in millennials' earning power, recent income gains by younger workers have now helped them to catch up. Sophie Hale, the think tank's principal economist, said, "Young people across advanced economies were hit by the financial crisis of 2008, putting a stop to decades of progress. 15 years on, this crisis cohort are no longer young. And while other countries' millennials have bounced back, their counterparts in Britain are still wearing economic scars as they approach middle age. US millennials in their early 30s in 2021 were earning 21% more in real terms than people in the same age group were in 2007. However, in Britain, incomes were still 1% lower for this group than for the 30 to 34-year-olds 15 years earlier. Explaining the divergence, the report's authors pointed to long-term wage stagnation in the United Kingdom, which has been particularly bad for young graduates due to Britain's economy's inability to create enough skilled jobs. They wrote, The typical weekly pay of university graduates aged between 30 and 34 has fallen by 16% between 2007 and 2023, while the typical weekly pay of non-graduates is down by only 6%. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Sky-high housing costs in Britain have also meant many millennials have struggled to afford their own home at the same age as their parents or grandparents. The Resolution Foundation found that there had been some catch-up in recent years, but the millennials still remain a long way behind. The report said, around the turn of the millennium, 67% of households aged 30 to 34 were homeowners. But by 2021, this figure was still 20 percentage points lower at 47%. However, US officials claim in their country, homeownership rates have fallen by much less. 56% of 30 to 34-year-olds owned their home 2 decades ago, and in 2021, it was 50%. Sophie Hale, a British economist, said the low home ownership rates in Britain meant that many millennials were forced to live in high-cost and often low-security private rented accommodation that further impedes their living standards. Darren Jones, Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, said this report paints a stark picture of an economy that no longer works for working people, adding, 13 years of the Conservatives have left an entire generation falling behind their international counterparts and no better off than their parents' generation. Ben Twomey, chief executive of the campaign group Generation Rent, said the last 10 years had been a lost decade for housing in Britain. Ben Twomey added, policies like Help to Buy have only helped existing homeowners by increasing house prices. Most young adults continue to shell out excessive rents that make it harder to save for the future, while those lucky enough to have bought could only do so by taking on large debts and are now facing crushing increases in mortgage payments. Ben Twomey added, at least now there is action to make life better for renters through the Renters Reform Bill, but it needs to go further to give those of us locked out of home ownership the chance of a long-term home. The tough economic conditions endured by millennials may help to explain the fact that they appear not to have followed their forebears in moving to the political right as they have aged. A recent YouGov opinion poll suggested that just 12% of 25 to 49-year-olds intend to vote Conservative at the next general election. The Centre for Policy Studies, a right-wing think tank, has published a new collection of essays titled Justice for the Young, that call for policies to help close the generation gap, including cheaper childcare and reform of student loans. Its director, Robert Colville, said, the divide between the young and the old is becoming Britain's defining characteristic, not just politically, but economically as well. The website of CNBC has also covered the same story and tells us more. Researchers found young people who entered Britain's labour market amid the 2008 financial crisis are still scarred by its impact on their employment and earnings potential. According to a new report, the so-called crisis cohort who entered the world of work following the financial meltdown of 2008 have continued to face higher unemployment, lower pay, and worse job prospects more than a decade later. Published recently by the British think tank, the Resolution Foundation, the study says that while Britain avoided a repeat of the mass youth unemployment seen in the 1980s, the impact of the financial crisis in 2008 was spread more evenly across young people, mostly in the form of a prolonged squeeze on pay. Low-skilled workers who left education during 2008 and 2011 were 30% less likely to find employment than before the downturn. And researchers said the effect lasted for almost a decade. However, the report noted that the lowest paid were afforded some protection by the minimum wage. Meanwhile, graduates who entered Britain's labour market during the same period were a third more likely to be in low-paid work up to 7 years on from the downturn. According to the report, this group of graduates were paid 6% less than graduates who entered the workforce before the downturn, with their wages taking up to 7 years to recover. According to the report, this matters because time spent in low-paying occupations reduces someone's future earnings prospects, not just because pay progression is weaker in these occupations, but also because moving to higher-paying occupations is relatively rare and pay effects do not immediately unwind when and if someone does. The Resolution Foundation urged policymakers to focus on the lasting effects of the financial crisis on young people's prospects, adding that Britain's lawmakers should be preparing for the next economic downturn. Stephen Clark, senior economic analyst at Resolution Foundation think tank, said in a recent press release that people who entered the world of work amid the financial crisis were still facing significant scarring effects. He added, low-skilled workers faced a higher risk of unemployment, while university graduates were more likely to trade down the types of jobs they did, with their pay and prospects stunted as a result. Stephen Clark added, these scarring effects have stayed with the crisis cohort for up to a decade, reducing their living standards at a time when they may be facing the additional financial strains of buying a home or bringing up young children.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Israeli carnage in the Gaza Strip continues to rack up deaths, especially women and children. But Israel is also impacted by its genocidal war when it comes to its international standing, putting into doubt its legitimacy. Ireland's opposition party has strongly blasted the regime, accusing it of committing barbaric and cowardly war crimes.
The world sees Israeli actions for what they are: barbaric, hateful, cowardly war crimes.
Strong words from the leader of Ireland's opposition party. The Brazilian president relayed his disgust on Israeli crimes when it came to hospitals being targeted.
I'd never heard of children being the preferred victims of a war. The number of women and children who have already died and the number of children who have gone missing is unheard of in any other war.
Hospitals have become a focal point of the war. The Israeli military shared video and photographs showing what it said were weapons stored by Hamas in the basement of a children's hospital in Gaza, where it also said hostages appear to have been held.
And we also found signs that indicate that Hamas held hostages here. This is currently under our investigation, but we also have intelligence that verifies it.
Currently under our investigation is another way of Israel saying that it is not sure. At the same time, it is trying to portray itself as a good Samaritan by delivering fuel to the hospitals. But this amount of fuel is just a drop in the bucket, way too short of what hospitals need. Yet Israel got a boost on its war efforts when the U.S. President Joe Biden said that hospitals in the Gaza Strip must be protected.
Well, I have not been reluctant in expressing my concerns what's going on. And it's my hope and expectation that there will be less intrusive action relative to the hospital.
Biden said he was hoping for less intrusive action by Israel. That was another way of saying that he supported Israel's military operation against the hospitals. The more Israel's genocidal war in the Gaza Strip continues, the more it will come at a cost for Israel and its supporters. The Israeli foreign minister gave his idea of a timeline of when the war may end. He said that Israel has between 2 and 3 weeks left before international pressure intensifies. Before it intensifies? By many accounts, that threshold has been passed already, evident through the mass worldwide protests. But the real question remains, what are Israel's plans for Palestinians? A host of Israeli officials have made statements recently which reveal what those plans may be. Israeli Minister Smotrich said on X that he supports voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza as the right humanitarian solution. Dani Danan, former ambassador to the UN, and Ram Bin Barak, former deputy director of the Mossad, published a commentary in the Wall Street Journal suggesting moving some people of Gaza to nations that will accept them. And the former director of Israel's spy agency, Shin Bet, who is currently serving as the Minister of Agriculture, said that Tel Aviv was rolling out a Nakba in the Gaza Strip. Let's not forget, Israel has denied that a Nakba ever took place. Furthermore, in 2011, Israel enacted a Nakba law that authorized the withdrawal of state funds from organizations that discussed the Nakba.
The Israeli minister has claimed that dropping a nuclear bomb on the blockaded Gaza Strip is an option. The Israeli heritage minister Eliyahu made the remarks in an interview with Radio Kol Barama. Eliyahu also insisted that allowing any humanitarian aid into Gaza was wrong, claiming there is no such thing as uninvolved civilians in Gaza, calling the innocent civilian population in Gaza Nazis. Following the remarks, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended the minister from cabinet meetings. Hamas resistance movement, however, pointed out that Eliyahu's remarks were reflective of the Netanyahu regime's genocidal mindset.
The statement by what is called the Israeli heritage minister in the Zionist cabinet that throwing a nuclear weapon on the Gaza Strip is one of the solutions didn't come out of nowhere, but it is an expression on the level of decadence, Nazism and sadism that takes place in the minds of the cabinet of the occupying entity that is based on murder and genocide.
The remarks also drew condemnation from around the Arab world, and Iran called for a swift international response. The United Nations Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency must take immediate and uninterrupted action to disarm this barbaric and apartheid regime. Russia has joined a chorus of condemnation that was sparked over controversial remarks made by an Israeli minister about the regime's openness to a nuclear strike in the Gaza Strip. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, said that the main issue was that Israel appeared to have admitted that it had nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Arab states have all denounced the comments. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abolteit has said the remarks reveal that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, which is an open secret. He also added that the comments also confirm the truth of the racist view Israelis hold against Palestinians. Since Israel's war began on Gaza on October the 7th, the Israeli military has dropped more than 25,000 tons of explosives on Gaza, equivalent in power to two of the nuclear bombs used on Hiroshima. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor has said Israel has admitted to bombing over 12,000 targets in the Gaza Strip, with a record tally of bombs exceeding 10 kilograms of explosives per individual. Israel's use of internationally banned weapons in its attacks on the Gaza Strip has also been documented, especially the use of cluster and phosphorus bombs. The Israeli regime is estimated to possess 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the sole possessor of non-conventional arms in the Middle East and the wider West Asia region. Tel Aviv, however, neither admits nor denies owning the weapons under a policy of deliberate nuclear ambiguity. It has also defied international calls for it to sign the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT, something that further corroborates its running of an offensive nuclear weapons program. The United Nations General Assembly has already backed a resolution urging the regime to give up its nuclear weapons and join the NPT.
Gaza Strip skyline. Israel's bombing campaign continues. An apocalyptic scene. It appears Israel is using the banned white phosphorus bombs again. Bombs which burns the skin down to the bone. The death toll continues to mount, like at the Al-Maghazi camp. 51 Palestinians murdered. Another massacre on top of the others. Genocide on speed. The cries over the loss of a beloved one, which is why people are angry worldwide. But the biggest rally for Palestinians ever to have taken place in Washington, D.C. The war is coming at a cost for Israel. Diplomatically, Bolivia cut off relations with Israel, with Turkey, Colombia, Chad, and Honduras recalling their ambassadors. Persian Gulf Arab leaders meeting with the U.S. Secretary of State. They all called for a ceasefire, but Blinken did not blink. No to a ceasefire, and on a humanitarian pause, a big maybe.
It's our view that a ceasefire now would simply leave Hamas in place.
Yet Blinken had only echoed Netanyahu's statements on a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas.
David Petraeus, the retired general of the U.S. Army, responsible in part for his failure in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, in a leaked audio file, encouraged and approved Israel's carnage in Gaza.
I see no alternative to the destruction of Hamas, and I use that term specifically because, as Aviv knows, there's a military doctrinal term. It's a gradation. You know, you can disrupt, you can deny, you can defeat, you can destroy.
But he must not have been prepared for what an Israeli minister said when asked whether an atomic bomb should be dropped on the Gaza Strip. Amihai Eliyahu said this is one of the possibilities. Let's not forget, the Gaza Strip has already been hit by an atomic bomb. But not at once. Slowly, 25,000 tons dropped on the Strip so far. The resistance fighters slammed these comments as reflective of the evil and terrorist nature of the regime, while they fought street battles against the Israeli regime forces. Israel has suffered casualties as a result. The tide may be turning, with costs mounting for the U.S. and Israel. For Israel, the worldwide anti-Israel protests have shattered its image. These protests have also worked against the U.S.
It's definitely ceasefire. People are getting killed every minute.
In the U.S., there are worries about the aftermath of the war. It's time for Israel's friends to recognize that the current operational approach is causing an unacceptable level of civilian harm and does not appear likely to achieve the goal of permanently ending the threat from Hamas, is what this high-ranking senator said. In other words, the U.S. is at the phase of the war where people are starting to worry about how they will look when this is over. And they are worried about votes also, as cynical as that sounds. Muslim and Arab American groups have threatened to not vote for Biden in 2024. This includes Democratic Party leaders from contested states that can decide elections, such as Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That, combined with the sanctioning of Israeli products, which has also gained traction, especially amongst the Generation Zs in the U.S., and not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is turning Gaza hospitals into morgues. Recent reports say conditions at Gaza hospitals have seriously deteriorated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Road, the Israeli occupation army has surrounded Al-Shifa and other hospitals in Gaza with tanks and snipers, as this report is being compiled. The largest medical complex in Gaza comprising three specialized facilities, surgical, internal medicine, and obstetrics, Al-Shifa is being turned into a morgue. It has patients and newborn babies in incubators, as well as thousands of Palestinian families displaced from their homes by relentless Israeli regime bombardment. The hospital is being targeted and is under threat of bombing and destruction. The Zionist regime has already bombed the entrance to the hospital, and recently several ambulances were attacked by Israeli regime missiles, killing 15 injured people that were being transported. The ambulances carrying injured patients were on their way to the Rafah crossing to take them to Egypt for treatment. Instead, the Zionist regime's planes bombed the road the Palestinian Red Crescent Society ambulances were traveling on, forcing them to return. As the ambulances arrived near the entrance of Al-Shifa Hospital, the Zionist regime planes bombed them, killing the injured Palestinian civilians. Now, Israeli occupation forces have surrounded Al-Shifa Hospital with tanks and snipers, are shooting anyone who comes in their sight. The Zionist regime's war criminals allege that Hamas has a command center under the hospital, an accusation the hospital's director has rejected as utter lies. The Zionist regime has peddled other lies, like
the beheading of 40 Israeli babies or the killing of civilians by Hamas. All have been debunked by the Zionist regime sources themselves, but that has not prevented the pro-Israeli Western media and politicians from repeating them. Al-Shifa Hospital director Mohammad Abu Salmiya was quoted as saying that the medical complex was cut off from the outside world and under Israeli fire. Gaza's health ministry director Munir Al-Barsh said any moving object around Al-Shifa Hospital is a target for the Zionist regime forces. The number of dead is so high that it has led to plans to dig a massive grave within the hospital premises. Al-Barsh said, "We cannot move within or outside the perimeter of the hospital. We are surrounded. We cannot bury our dead. We are going to create a mass grave within the hospital compound." In addition to Al-Shifa Hospital, Al-Quds Hospital is also being targeted. The Zionist regime forces are within meters of the hospital and firing tank shells at the building. According to a CNN report, Annas Hospital and Al-Rentisi Pediatric Hospital in northern Gaza are also being attacked. Doctors and medical staff say that they will be killed any minute together with thousands of civilians that have sought shelter there. Targeting hospitals, schools, and residential buildings constitute war crimes. Israeli political and military rulers are guilty of heinous crimes and must be held accountable for perpetrating a genocide in Gaza. According to the World Health Organization, half of Gaza's 36 hospitals have shut down due to lack of electricity and medicines. Gaza's Deputy Health Minister, Dr. Yusuf Abu Al-Arish, currently inside Al-Shifa Hospital as it comes under heavy fire from Israeli forces, spoke to Al Jazeera. Here are his translated comments reported by the Qatari channel. "This is a moment we have been warning the world of. All generators are off. All power sources are cut. We have 39 newborns in incubators. Those babies are fighting against death. No one is able to move around the compound. The snipers are stationed all over the place in addition to the drones that target and kill any moving person. A few minutes ago, one of the engineering team was hit by a sniper. He was hit in the neck and was paralyzed and he is now about to die. Part of the hospital was shelled and part of the building caught fire. We fear it will engulf the whole compound. A few families tried to leave, but they were targeted. Now they are lying dead outside the hospital. We cannot get to them. We are totally stranded. We are cut off from the outside world. And above all, we are left without any medical resources. We cannot even bury the dead. Ferocious gunfire can be heard within the vicinity of the hospital. The intensive care unit received a mortar shell a few minutes ago. Blood is everywhere, on the floor. We cannot even clean it. In the past, the Israeli killing machine was killing, and this was conveyed on TV screens. Now they are perpetrating the same killing, but no one is listening. No one is watching. The whole world is standing by. We are speaking with whatever is left of my phone battery. After that, we will be silent." Ashraf Al-Qudra, spokesperson of Gaza's health ministry, says the displaced people, wounded, and medical staff inside Al-Shifa Hospital are suffering due to the lack of food and water. The situation is worsened by the power blackout, with fear also spreading due to the heavy gunfire by the Zionist regime forces, he added. Al-Qudra said, "We are besieged inside Al-Shifa Medical Complex. Inflicting collective punishment on innocent civilians also constitutes a war crime. Israeli rulers are guilty of genocide, collective punishment, and ethnic cleansing. Western rulers are complicit in the Zionist regime's war crimes. According to Al Jazeera English, conditions at both the Indonesian and Al-Shifa hospitals, as well as other hospitals in Gaza, have seriously deteriorated since Al Jazeera last spoke to Al-Haq recently. Dr. Mohammad Abu Salmia, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital, warned recently that hundreds of injured people, as well as newborn babies, needed to be urgently transported to an operational medical facility, as his hospital was crumbling under the strain of a lack of fuel and medicine, as well as the Zionist regime's bombardments. Abu Salmia told Al Jazeera English, "It's a tragedy. The dead bodies, we cannot put them in freezers as they are not functioning, so we decided to dig a pit in the vicinity of the hospital. It's a very inhumane scene. The situation is totally out of control. Hundreds of bodies are decomposing." Atef Al-Kahlot, the director of the Indonesian hospital, said his facility is operating only at between 30 to 40% of capacity, and he made an appeal for the world to help. He said, "We call on the honorable people of the world, if any of them are left, to put pressure on the occupation forces to supply the Indonesian hospital and the rest of the hospitals in the Gaza Strip."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam by Ayatollah Khamenei. The issue of Palestine is the world of Islam's top priority, November 23rd, 2017. Today, the issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam. Anyone who has a correct understanding of the issue of Palestine acknowledges that the issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam. The key to defeating the enemies of Islam is the issue of Palestine. The most important issue of the world of Islam in the present time is the issue of Palestine. Why is that? This is because Palestine is an Islamic country. They have come and occupied this country. They have taken it away from its people. The issue is not about usurping a village or a city. The enemy has usurped a country, and it has used it as a base for jeopardizing the security of regional countries. One should fight against a cancerous tumor. Notice that if a person issues a fatwa as a religious mufti saying that the fighting against Zionism is haram, that helping such and such a group which is fighting against Zionism is not allowed, this is really a disaster to witness that some people in the world of Islam are acting against the interest of Islam and have friendly relations with the enemies. This is the exact opposite of the Quran's clear words. Those who are with him are strong against unbelievers, but compassionate among each other. The Holy Quran, chapter 48, verse 29. However, those people are strong against Muslims, but compassionate among unbelievers. They are on good terms with them, but notice what they are doing to Muslims.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Forgetting the issue of Palestine is the enemy's goal. December 17, 2016. If Muslims are united, Palestine will not be in the situation that it is in now. Today, Palestine is in a difficult situation. Gaza and the West Bank are in a difficult situation, both in different ways. Today, the people of Palestine are under serious pressures on a daily basis. They want to erase the issue of Palestine from the minds of people and co-sign it to oblivion. They want to, as they say, busy the West Asian region, including our own countries. This is an extraordinarily sensitive and strategic region. It is a sensitive region in terms of geography, natural resources, and sea passageways with themselves. They want Muslims to stand up against Muslims and Arabs against Arabs. They want them to target and destroy one another so that the armies of Muslim countries, particularly those armies that are neighboring the Zionists, weaken on a daily basis. This is their goal.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
You. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In Gaza, the situation is getting worse, no longer by the day, but by the hour. Incessant Israeli bombardments and its refusal to lift a crippling blockade on the enclave has led to a humanitarian disaster, as described by the ICRC. More than half of the hospitals in Gaza have closed down. The situation is described as intolerable by Iranians who have supported the Palestinian resistance from day one. On the streets of Tehran, people are calling this an unbearable human tragedy unfolding before their very eyes.
We have them in any way, shape, or form that we can. The entire world is watching silently, and even Western countries, and the U.S. in particular, are blatantly supporting the Zionists as they commit these atrocities. The Palestinians are our Muslim brothers and sisters, and we have to do everything we can do to help them.
The most barbaric scenes that one could imagine are coming out of Gaza. I couldn't sleep the night as I saw images of a hospital in Gaza where a young child pulled from under the rubble was all alone crying. He was probably the only one left from his family, just like many other kids there. How can the world do nothing? all countries should call for an immediate ceasefire.
I can't believe that in year 2023 we are witnessing such atrocities. It is completely unbelievable. No one is trying to stop the Zionists. Why? Just because Palestinians don't have blonde hair and blue eyes? Just because they are Muslims? They deserve to be treated this way. We saw how all these countries who are now supporting Israel were vocal when it was all about Ukraine.
Currently, over 9 million Iranians have signed up to go to Gaza to help Palestinians in their fight for freedom.
Does international law mean anything at all, or it is just for some countries to benefit from? History will judge them. Such atrocities are complete.